Welcome to another edition of The Spirit Revolution. My name is Philip Coppens.
My name is Kathleen McGowan.
And we have traded in the scenery of a wintry yet very warm Los Angeles. And we have arrived after a week of doing research in England, in Scotland. And one of the things which we were doing last week was preparing a DVD for a series which is something of along the lines of Philip Coppens Investigates, even though that's not going to be the title. And the first one we did was go out into actually to Washington State to talk about Roswell. And that'll be coming out later in the year. But we were preparing the second DVD in this series. And for that, we spoke to Duncan Lunan. Now, people might remember Duncan from an appearance he made on The Spirit Revolution, if I'm not mistaken, at the end of May of 2011. And oh my God, it's almost a year ago since we did that show. But Duncan and I remained in contact because for those people who have heard that interview, and for people who might have read my book, The Ancient Alien Question, they know that Duncan has been working on something which is of tremendous interest to me. And once it gets released, I'm sure to millions of other people as well. And this is a very strange story. The story is quite often labeled Children from the Sky or The Green Children from Woolpit. And in a very nutshell, the story is this, that one day, in the height of the summer, two children, who are green in color, appear literally out of nowhere.
In 1173.
And they are found just outside of the tiny village of Woolpit. Now, Woolpit is roughly, I would say, about 100 miles north-northeast of London in England, in East Anglia. And obviously, the fact that they are green means that they stand out. They get taken in. They get taken to a local kind of sheriff equivalent who takes them in. And to cut a very long story short, because we're going to go into this story in more detail as we go along in this show, but also with Duncan at a future moment in time. Basically, what happens is that these two children don't speak English, have a green collar, and are taken in. And as they grow older and they stay around, they begin to learn English. Now, the boy, unfortunately, dies relatively soon, within the year, it is believed. And the girl continues to live into adulthood. And she learns English, and she is beginning to express that they come from a place where it is eternal twilight, where there is a river, and across the river they can see sunlight. So wherever it is, it's clearly nothing at all like our Earth, where obviously we have day and night, and they don't have that. They have more like eternal twilight. Obviously, we don't have people who have green skin tone here on planet Earth. But she loses that skin tone over time as she probably becomes more and more exposed to direct sunlight, something which she doesn't have on her home world. And so this story was written down a few years, the first time when she was still alive, and then was repeated in a number of chronicles after her death. And it was largely treated as folklore. It was largely isolated, if not forgotten. Woolpit remembered, obviously, but outside of Woolpit, really very few people knew about it. And then in 1993, Duncan began to investigate and hasn't stopped since. And in later this year, in May, his book on the story is going to be published. And then shortly afterwards, the DVD, which we are doing with him, is going to be released as well. And obviously, this DVD had to have certain footage of Woolpit, which is why Kathleen and I dashed to Woolpit after we had landed at London Heathrow. And it is, you know, it's a very interesting story, and we are going to talk about it, but we're also going to segue into a story which Kathleen is writing on at the moment, a new series. And pretty much, you know, for people who have been following Ancient Aliens, for people who are following us, what is this thing? Kind of like, what is the difference? We have been talking about angels. We have been talking about extraterrestrials. Then you have fairies. There's an awful lot of non-human intelligences out there. And the question is, where do they all come from? Are they all the same? Are they all different? How should we approach this? And so we're going to approach it in a kind of, I would say, interdimensional way today.
Well, because I think dimensional is the key word here. I mean, for me, you know, and we'll talk about this as we get into the Woolpit story a little bit. You know, who are these green children? Where do they come from? You know, we see this over and over. We're in the heartland of Celtic country where we live in Scotland, and you know, the legends of the fairy kingdoms are so powerful here. There are so many stories of people going in and out of fairy world. Certainly, in Ireland where I lived and my family came from. I also have encountered a number of fairy stories. I mean, I'm not just talking about, oh, picking them up in a book. I'm talking about stories that are alive in the culture and that everybody talks about. And so the question becomes, where does all this come from? What does it mean? How ancient are these stories? And what's really going on in them? Are we talking about other dimensions? Are we talking about time travel? Are we talking about extraterrestrial? Is it an and universe? Are we talking about all of these things? But I do think this concept of other dimensions is something that is overlooked, I think, more often than not, as we go into some of these theories. And that's something that I really wanted to take a look at. To back up to Woolpit, wow. This whole story of the green children of Woolpit has really, really captured my imagination. And I'm just in love with the story. And going to Woolpit was such a delight for me. I mean, I could have stayed there for many more days just to soak up the atmosphere of the place. First of all, it's a beautiful little village. It's super atmospheric. And as the curator of the Woolpit Museum, who's a very funny man named John, and forgive me because I don't remember his last name, and I wish I did, a great character and keeper of the local history. As he said to us one night in the pub, he said, everything in Woolpit is older than America. And he's not kidding. You know, it's one of those villages in England that I think Americans especially dream about when you dream about what the English countryside should look like. You know, when you dream about what old England might look like, it's the kind of place that you really want to take Americans to because they would really get a sense of it. The church was built in 1005. You know, there are half timbered houses. There are Tudor aged houses and some that are even older. There are thatched houses. You know, it's a wonderful, very charming little village. And yet it's also, it has this underlying sense of a power place. There's something very, very interesting going on in Woolpit. And, you know, you can talk to this too. As we arrived in Woolpit in the late afternoon and it was getting dark, and it was a particularly gray and dark day, so it was very moody to begin with. And when we drove into it, I at first found it very oppressive and a little bit scary. I was kind of creeped out by it. I thought, oh, I don't know about this place. It feels like the setting of a science fiction movie. And then the next day, I felt completely different about it when the sun came up and all of that. But there was an essence to it. And the only thing I can compare it to is the first time I arrived in Rennes-le-Château. I had that same sense. Now, I've been to a lot of mysterious places. I've been to a lot of powerful places in my life and my years of exploring. You know, 4 continents, 20 years searching out these mysteries. I've seen a lot of amazing things. But Woolpit is the only place that has ever had that sense to me, that same feeling that I get sometimes going up that mountain in Rennes-le-Château, where I feel like time and space are playing with me. I feel like there's something happening under the surface that is not entirely for us to grasp as humans. Did you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. You know, first of all, in Woolpit, it was very prominent. You could literally sense it. If it's, in fact, when I when we were unloading the car, it was almost like you could point and say, it's right over there where the mystery lies, where that other dimension is accessed. And yes, absolutely, Rennes-le-Château as well. We've spoken about how, you know, Rennes-le-Château is this gateway between worlds, how the Tree of Life was molded, depicted by Sonnier in that place to break through the time and space, the Versailles incident as well, this gateway from where time and space just don't appear to behave as if they should. And the same thing is to be said really for Woolpit, I think. It's, I think, part of the reason why what happened in Woolpit is because it is in Woolpit, because it is one of those places. And this is definitely something which Duncan is saying as well. In fact, Duncan is going quite a bit into the what I would call the geology and the geography of why certain mysterious places happen in certain places. And he, I mean, it you know, we will let him talk about that himself, but basically he's saying that these things don't happen everywhere or can happen everywhere, that they occur in very specific places, and that Woolpit is one of these places. And definitely that is something which I think we have experienced as well, and definitely, you know, in Woolpit that was the case. And I just want to go into one aspect, which is that whenever we talk about ancient aliens, specifically in the new season of Ancient Aliens season 4, which has just started, the graphics, whenever we talk about ancient aliens and some of the descriptions, have very much to do with the way we travel today. With space shuttles, with rockets technology, and how there are vapor trails, and how somehow, you know, these were linked with the gods. It's a very basic form of traveling. It's very much combustible engines and power, and going from A to B in a quite often slow way, and also in a way which is basic, in the sense that there's no real understanding of the power or the fabric of the universe. A far more interesting approach was what Jodie Foster and Matthew McConaughey depicted, and in Carl Sagan's film Contact. You know, very visually there, obviously based on a book by Carl Sagan called Contact as well. And in there, you really see this interdimensional travel more. They go to, or she goes to meet the aliens through something whereby she somehow experiences 16 hours of it. But for the people on Earth, it's a failed experiment, because they've only seen the capsule in which she is sitting disappear for a nanosecond, and therefore they think that nothing has happened, that it's failed, that this, you know, this device simply doesn't work. And she points out that it does, but that what appears to be a few seconds on planet Earth, or not even that, actually was 16 hours where she went, and she basically traveled interdimensionally. And this is something which you see an awful lot about. And with the Woolpit case scenario, it's interesting, because you clearly have two children who, despite criticism, and again, we will go into that with Duncan, so many people have tried to explain away as to how these children could not possibly be from a different world. The language they would speak would somehow be Flemish. they would come from Flanders. Now, I come from Flanders, and I can tell you in winter it's grey, but it is not eternal twilight. It's only like that for a few weeks or months at a time during the winter time.
And I can tell you that I listen to you speak Flemish, and it is unusual to an English-speaking ear, but it's not an alien language.
All of these things, kind of, you know, they try to explain these things away, but basically what they are saying, or what the legend is saying, is this, that the children were somewhere else, were normally restricted in where they were allowed to go, but somehow go in a place where they were pretty much told off of never going there, because they're following bells, or they're following something, a sound, and it takes them into a cave, and then all of a sudden they appear in an earthwork just outside of Woolpit. You know, no spaceship, no physical abduction involving grey aliens, just something. They were in one space, in one place in one time, then all of a sudden find themselves somewhere else. And that is something which we've seen to a large extent in these time slips episodes. In the case of Versailles, you know, the women find themselves in the same space, but not in the same time. And obviously, it's like an in and out kind of effect. In the case of Randall Chateau, it's the same thing. It's like, it's the same space, but somehow certain things are wrong. In the case of Woolpit, something more dramatic happens. And actually, Duncan has theories as to why that happened at that specific moment in time. Again, we leave that to him. But it is also very similar to what you're researching at this moment in time, which is the fairy stories, these ideas that people are taken by the fairies, are abducted into another dimension, meet other beings. To some extent, the UFO abduction literature is like that as well. In fact, Whitley Strieber put some of his abduction experiences in forests, very much like some of the fairy stories. It involves some of the UFO abduction material, beautiful women. Again, something which you find in fairy tradition. It also involves mysterious creatures and grey. And then, of course, the story you're working on, which we'll talk about a bit today, but also at a later moment in time, also involves this grey aspect. So nothing is new under the sun, and it seems almost as if we've been approaching an awful lot of this from a very basic point of view, in the sense that we quite often try to say, okay, to go from place A to B, we need to have combustion engines and rockets, and we need to develop these. And once we were able to do this, we will go very much like the Starship Enterprise at warp speed to these places. But there also seems to be something which our ancestors knew about, which our ancestors to some extent feared and spoke to their children about, of saying, well, there are places on planet Earth where if you're not careful, certain weird things might happen, and watch it. Because there's no guarantee, whereas in a time slip, Oliver Tsai, you'll come out of it. It might not be as straightforward in certain other places on planet Earth.
Absolutely. There was always that fear that you might not come back. And that was, I think that there was a very common warning, particularly in the Celtic worlds, to children and to adults. Look, there are certain places you do not go at certain times. At certain times, because the veil is thin, and this has to do with astronomical points of view. This is where we have the legends that, this is where Halloween comes from, right? The legend that at Samhain, the veil between the worlds is thinnest and opens, and the other worlds can come into our world, and if we're not very careful, we can also fall into theirs. I remember the first time I saw Contact, since you brought this up, one of the things that I loved about it was it did play with this idea of time, and how time is out of mind and out of space in different places. So whereas something is experienced as a second here, Jodie Foster experiences as 16 hours in this dimensional world in which she is traveling. Is it space? Is it dimension? What is it? I don't know. But there's a time issue, and this is the thing that is consistent in all of the legends that involve the fairy folk or the other worlds in the Celtic countries. There are always time anomalies. There's always something that is a moment here, or the other way around, a moment there, is many, many years here. Being Irish, I grew up with a lot of these stories. And then when I was a teenager and I went to Ireland for the first time, I just really, really fell in love with all the fairy folklore and started to collect it. So I've been on this path for about 30 years of looking at these stories. I think the most famous of them is the legend of Oisin, who rides off to the fairyland with a beautiful Niamh, who he falls in love with. And as much as he loves her and is happy in fairyland, he pines to see his old friends, back in at home on the mainland, and away from the land of the young, which is what the Irish called it, right? The land of the fairy folk was called Tír na n Óg, the land of the young. But when Oisin comes back and falls from his horse, he becomes human again. And of course, all of a sudden, it turns out that he is very, very ancient. He is several hundred years old. So whereas it only feels like he was gone in the fairy country for a few years, in human terms, it was several hundred years. So you have a lot of that. A day here is 100 there and vice versa. But there's always an issue with time and how time works, or that they don't age. Tír na n Óg is the land of the young because in the land of the fairy, nobody gets older. So you definitely have these time anomalies. And so, there's something interesting that happens in Woolpit, in the fact that these children do just sort of arrive. And when the girl is later interviewed, Agnes is what they call her, when Agnes is later interviewed after she does speak English, she talks about the fact that they're in the fields with their father's herd, and they hear this sound, which they think is beautiful, and they follow it. And the next thing they know, they're in this other place. So the question for me becomes, is this a time travel circumstance? Is this dimensional? Or is it a time issue? Or is it both? You know, we laugh about the critics. The critics say, oh, well, the children were suffering from a condition called chlorosis, which is something that makes the skin green. And we have since learned from Duncan that there is no such thing as chlorosis. And just to plug Duncan here, Duncan Lunan's book, Children from the Sky, will be out at the end of May. It is the most thoroughly researched, extraordinary book on the subject that will ever be available. And it deserves to be picked up just for the sheer amount of information that is in it. I think that Duncan comes to conclusions which you are comfortable with that I may not be, which have a lot to do with the alien UFO theory. I think I am more inclined to be terrestrial. Rather than thinking these children came from the sky, I actually think that there might be something else happening here. I am more inclined, and this is because of my own history and my own upbringing and the legends that I have studied for such a long time. I think this Woolpit story is very harmonious with a lot of those beliefs that come out of the Celtic countries. So for me, when I see that these children appear out of nowhere in Woolpit, I wonder if it's not more of a terrestrial thing or a time thing. And again, the critics tried to explain it away by saying they had gotten lost from a Flemish community. And we laugh about that. And the last time I was in Belgium, I don't remember seeing anyone who was bright green. And that's the other thing that the critics will say, oh, they ate too many beans and that's why their skin was green. One of the things you have to remember is the description of these children's skin was that it was bright green. It was an intense, deep shade of green, and it was throughout their entire body. It wasn't that their skin had a green pallor. They were Margaret Hamilton in The Wizard of Oz, bright green. And that's one of the things that's really exceptional here.
Well, and also, like, you know, like if there was a Flemish community there, you would expect that they were all eating the same thing, including their mother and father. And that whenever two green children turn up in that area, everybody locally says, like, oh, they must come from the Flemish community who are eating beans a few, you know, 10 miles or so to the north. None of that happens. The reason why it was recorded is because it is so remarkable. It's on par with an awful lot of the fairy material, and it actually is recorded before an awful lot of the fairy material. This is, you know, this is written down at the end of the 12th century. This is a very old written down verse, and there are several of them. You know, there's the Bishop of Lyon, who the famous quote of Magonia. Very similar, kind of like, you know, creatures appear in and near Lyon, in southern France, a city there, and speak of this land called Magonia. The children here speak of a land which they then identify as St. Martin's land, which isn't a physical description. And again, Duncan goes into detail as to why it became like that.
Duncan has an excellent explanation for this whole St. Martin's land thing. Critics cling to this, and what happens is critics say, yes, well, Agnes also says later on that she comes from St. Martin's land, and she comes from a place where there are lots of churches. Therefore, it can't be another dimension. It can't be an alien planet. It has to be a Christianized community somewhere. But Duncan, in his extraordinary thorough nature, has come up with, I think, a truly excellent explanation of why Agnes said they came from St. Martin's land and what that actually means. And to get that explanation, you'll have to buy his book.
But, I mean, I think the main point is this. There, whatever this land is, this fairy land, whether it is an alien planet, whether it is a different dimension but somehow on planet Earth, whether it's somehow subterranean, as some legends make it, there clearly is and always was an absolute conviction, if not knowledge, that we were not alone. That, you know, we inhabited this place with other beings. And this is something which you see across the world. The Hopi Indians speak of a time when the gods lived amongst them. And then the gods went to the hills. And then the gods disappeared from the hills as well. But somehow, wherever they are, they can still be contacted. The ancient Egyptians said very much the same thing. Thousands of years ago, the gods ruled and lived amongst them. And then they disappeared. And they hope they're going to come back. And here in Scotland and Celtic countries, what we see is very much the fact that from the 11th, 12th century onwards, we are at a crossroads in society. The traditional world is disappearing. When you look at the history of these islands, most of the habitation was along coastlines or rivers. And really only in Roman times did the vast deforestation of England begin, and the inland became more and more, you know, less forested. And at the 12th century, you have this careful balance, which what I would say on a mundane level is between nature and mankind, and you know, what perhaps should have been between fairyland and mankind. And then obviously the Industrial Revolution a few centuries later, and the balance swings dramatically towards man doing whatever they want and wherever they want on this land. But the fairy traditions, for a very long period of time, 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th, 16th century, still say that there are pockets within England, specifically Scotland, specifically Ireland, of where the fairies still reside, and where it is not the human laws which reign, but the laws of fairyland. And to some extent, these fairy tales are law books, so to speak, or mm-hmm. or manuals as to what to expect and what not to do if you go into places where you know, things are not as they seem. And like before, kind of like giving it back to you, the interesting thing here seems to me that this interdimensional travel, whatever we want to call it, seems to have been possible in a number of occasions and seems to have happened quite easily, quite quickly, quite naturally. But then we did certain things to the environment, and that stopped that from happening.
Well, I think that that is absolutely true. And I think that one of the things that the fairy world exists to do is to maintain the balances of nature. And I think often the stories of the fairies being particularly naughty or malicious are actually the fairies being guardian spirits of the earth. I mean, I think that some of the wicked stories of fairies are really fairies being maligned and misunderstood. Because their job is to protect the land. And so I think oftentimes fairies are pissed off at us in these tales. And to your point, a lot of these fairy legends in the Celtic countries are cautionary tales. They are laid out to tell you, look, you don't mess around with these forces. There are forces out there that are part of nature, and they're serious, and you have to know how to behave around them. And there are rules, and if you abide by the rules, you'll be okay. And, you know, even though these ideas go back thousands of years, they're still very prevalent in certain places. I mean, my time in Ireland in the 80s and the 90s and spending, you know, time out in the countryside for long periods, you know, in some very small farming communities where they still really practice these things. You know, before they would build a house, they would dig up the earth and turn over patches of earth and leave it there, and then watch it to make sure that the earth isn't disturbed. Because if the earth is disturbed, it means you're in fairy territory and the fairies are telling you not to build there. And you know what? They don't. You know, I used to live in a village in the Irish countryside several months out of the year, and there was a story of a man who had built his house in spite of the fact that the fairies had told him not to, and the house burned down. You know, so you and this, you know, this is in the 90s. this is just a few years ago. So, you know, these aren't even ancient tales. They're still very, very much alive, that you need to be paying attention to what the fairies are doing, because they are in charge. But again, it really, if you dig underneath the surface, it really is that essence of being a guardian spirit, of protecting the earth and protecting nature. So there are cautionary elements to this. Now, it's been interesting, since we've been in Scotland, we've been exploring this a lot. And there are more abduction tales here than I expected there to be. There are a lot of them in Ireland, and I spent a lot of time exploring them there, but I was surprised at how many there are here. And of course, the most famous in Scotland, I think, is the story of Thomas the Rhymer. Isn't necessarily an abduction tale. It's more on the lines of the story of Niamh Oisin, in that Thomas the Rhymer goes gladly with the gorgeous fairy queen that he falls for. Thomas the Rhymer was a real person. We think that Rhymer may have been his surname. He has since become more of a title, because he does go on to become kind of the Celtic Nostradamus, actually. But he is a laird in the border countries during the time of William Wallace and Robert the Bruce. Very extraordinary, colorful historical period. And within this period, he has an encounter in the Eildon Hills, and you can talk about them because you know a lot about how magical that place is. He has an encounter with a fairy queen, and depending on the story, she either kisses him or more, and he decides he's going with her, and he rides off with her to fairyland, and he lives there with her for 7 years. And at the end of 7 years, in throughout Scottish history, we see this in the fairy tales. At the end of 7 years, you're either kicked out of fairyland to go back to Earth to become human again, or you stay in fairyland and dwell forever. Well, apparently the fairy queen decided that Thomas needed to come back to Earth, and she sends him back. And she gives him a choice of two things. He can either become a harpist and a bard, or he can become a prophet. And Thomas decides that he wants to become a prophet. And when he returns to Scotland, to Earth, to the human world, he has these extraordinary powers of prophecy. And his prophecies have been long recorded and proven. He made a number of prophecies about the Scottish Wars, about some of the local things that were happening, but, you know, over and over again, his prophecies turned out to be true. And he went on to become known as True Thomas for two reasons. One, because the prophecies always turned out to be true, but because he was unable to lie after his 7 years in the fairy kingdom, because this is another aspect of the fairy world. In the fairy world, no one can lie. You don't, there is no lie in the fairy world. So, after his time in the fairy world, he was never able to tell a lie. So True Thomas always told the truth. But, you know, he goes on and he has his life here and he becomes this great prophet and a number of things happen. But at the end of his life, he disappears. And the story is that, he followed the fairy, that the fairy queen appeared to him, in the guise of a white hart, which is like a stag, like a deer. And he sees her and he follows her into the forest and he is never seen again because he has actually gone to join her to spend the rest of his life, however long and glorious that might be, with the fairy queen. So he's really the sort of the most famous of these stories.
Yes, and I mean, you know, there's another one, which is the story of a priest called Robert Kirk, who is probably most famous as the author of The Secret Commonwealth of Fairies and Elves, if I'm not mistaken, quite often shortened as The Secret Commonwealth. And he was a local priest in rural Scotland. And behind his church was a hill called Doon Hill. And it was said that the fairies lived there. And it's a very magical place. It's beautiful. And he basically captured the local fairy tradition and also some of the fairy tradition of surrounding areas. And he wrote it down, and it said that he didn't die, but that at the end of his life, the fairy queen took him in as one of her, because to some extent he was a messenger, a kind of ambassador of fairyland, educating and documenting this existence of the fairy realm. But, you know, one of the things I think we're always seeing is like this rural approach, which is needed, definitely in those times for the fairy kingdom still to be accessible and intact. And the Scottish borders are very much a uninhabited wilderness still. There's not so much forest there, but it's definitely uninhabited. When you are ever on a plane from London to Edinburgh and you're approaching Edinburgh, London to Glasgow, for several minutes you fly over the Scottish borders, this border between England and Scotland, which was inconquerable for so many people. The Romans feared it. Everybody, realized what was happening there. The border raiders in more medieval times. This is a vast natural barrier, which even today is remote. And it is in that region that you hear the strongest stories about how these fairies still are there and the magic of it. Alistair Moffat has written a number of books. He is a child of the borders, and he has written a series of books, and he's one of the people who actually sees the stories of King Arthur being located in there. And in Land of the Gods, I definitely follow his suit, though I do it in a slightly different way. But it is definitely clear that some of the land there was special. In Land of the Gods, I say this land, the reason why I call the book Land of the Gods is because the tribe which was living there were at one point in their Roman name called Votadini, but their Celtic name was Gogodin. And they were thrown out of the borders and ended up in Wales. And it is in Wales that they sort of are kind of regrouping. And at that moment in time, a new young man comes forward, and he is described as saying he's good, but he's not an Arthur. And it's the first reference to King Arthur. So it's clear that this Arthur, this tradition of Arthur was very strong amongst the Gododdin, that they saw him as one of them. And again, Alistair goes into detail as to where of these places are and kind of, again, in specifically the second part of Land of the Gods, I go into that as well. But it is a very magical region, and it is, irrelevant of the practical details of it being Camelot or not. Camelot also stands for this divine rule, where the king rules over his country in a very benign way, a very harmonious way. And that is another key message of so many things. And I'm jumping to the ancient Egyptians, where the pharaoh's task was to maintain a balance between this world and the world of the gods. He had one foot in either, and he stood at the threshold. And his job was to be a gateway between this world and the world of the gods, which was very much other dimensional. And the gods, were supposed to come, and we were supposed to go, and there was to be this exchange. But the worlds were very close, and that was the purpose. And the world would only be close if the rule of man was just, because if man did certain things in an atrocious way, that kind of clear but also careful boundary between the two worlds would first of all be broken, but also the intrusions of each world into the other would become more abrupt. And part of the fairy tradition is also to do with the warnings of when that is happening, when this balance is upset, and what you can expect then, as you were saying, as when the fairies are pissed off with mankind for what they have been doing. But this is definitely a worldwide phenomenon, that every culture has had this aspect of we are not alone, there is another dimension there, and the rulers of the community are there to maintain this contact and this balance between everyone and the two things. And in Celtic traditions, King Arthur is seen as the big personality who was able to do that, the pharaoh, so to speak, who does have that one foot into the other.
Well, he absolutely does, because the other thing that Arthur is able to do is Arthur is able to maintain balance. And depending on, which version of the legend you want to look at, he is doing that either with Guinevere or with Morgan at his side. But there is always a female balance for him. And the brief shining moment, really, in Camelot is that period where Arthur is able to keep one foot in each world. He is able to balance the ideas of Avalon, the ancient world, and this newly burgeoning, modern, and Christianized world. Arthur is able to maintain the balance between those things. The old and the new are capable of living together under his rule. So this is one of the things that was really interesting for me. I first came to Scotland in 1995 in search of Arthur in Scotland, because I was so fascinated by those ideas, and now to know that so much of the the, and I understand it so much better now because I've been doing this for so many more years than when I first came here, that so much of this, these ideas of Arthur potentially coming from Scotland or being a Scottish king come from the borders, and come from these places that, that have one foot in the fairy kingdom. So it makes a lot of sense, you know, for them and those traditions, Arthur is able to balance these things. He is living in the hollow Eldon Hills, and so is Merlin, and so is Thomas the Rhymer. You know, there are these places that are the holding place of the once and future king, the once and future prophet, the once and future, you know, Merlin or teacher. You know, that they all wait for us, and then they reappear when the time is right, which is an aspect of the time returns as well, right? That these that these sort of great mythical characters are going to come back to us. So, you know, this week we went off in search of some of these places and we're climbing around them and you know, specifically in search of my personal passion project, which I'm working on right now, which is the Ballad of Tam Lin. And Tam Lin is, in my opinion, the most sort of, it's the richest, it's the most electrifying and exciting of the fairy stories. For me, and this is in it, some say that it's based on the legend of Thomas the Rhymer. There are certainly similarities to it, but in the story of Tam Lin, it is a story of dramatic female courage, because in this case, the young knight is being held by the fairy queen against his will and is rescued by a human woman who has to go through a series of trials, about belief and love in order to rescue, this knight from the fairy queen's grasp. And, we went in search of these places that are mentioned in the Ballad of Tam Lin. It's one of the border ballads, and these are songs that were written. We would call them story songs in the modern times that tell these stories. And the Ballad of Tam Lin comes about in the latter part of the 16th century, although we know that the story is much, much older. So we went to the places mentioned in at Carter Haw, and what we found was that these are extremely magical places. There are places that are very powerful, but what I thought was really interesting is one of the great legends of the fairies, particularly of the fairy queens, is that they control the weather. And on the day that we went in search of the fairy queen's territory and the forests of Carter Haw and the places where Tam Lin and Thomas the Rhymer were both abducted, we had some very, very extraordinary weather.
Absolutely. And, you know, I spent quite a bit of time in Scotland, and there's a saying here, if you don't like this weather, wait 10 minutes and the weather will be something else. And to some extent that is true, but it's never as extreme, as it was, on Saturday, when really you had, you know, a snowstorm, and then you didn't just have sunshine, but you didn't have a cloud in the sky. It was just, you know, east to west, north to south, blue sky. And then 10 minutes later it was a snowstorm again, and then it was a rainstorm, and then again nothing but sunshine, and that is very dramatic. It is not like the standard Scottish weather that you know, it can be like that, but it's not as extreme as that, if that makes sense. And this was really a snowstorm, flurries of snow in always very interesting locations. Like the snow would always be actually in places where we were talking about bridges from this world to the other, because a bridge was quite often seen as a crossing of one world to another. Carter Haw, the location of Tam Lin ballad is very specific. It's not just, you know, any forest in the middle of anywhere. It's a very specific shape. It's with rivers. It's got to do with where it is situated. All of these things are again components which set aside as to why this is of specific interest, why specifically there the fairies would be, and why this is a specific gateway. And so all of these telltale signs, so to speak, of the fact that this is a special place, were underlined then. But yes, definitely the weather was extraordinary, and it was almost as if the fairy queen was to some extent saying, well, you know, you want to see what I can do, you want to explore this so you can write about this, well, let me demonstrate this, let me make it easy for you, let me not make it part of the imagination. You just have to be a chronicler rather than a novelist.
Well, and that was the beautiful thing, is that the Fairy Queen really spelled it out for us. And I wanted to actually take this moment to talk about the whole idea of the Fairy Queen. I like to think that she was working with us in this case by giving us these demonstrations. And really, we went from bright, warm sunshine to snowstorms in the course of 20 minutes. I mean, it was, I've never experienced anything like it. It was amazing. But here, one of the things that I'm doing with this particular little novella that I'm writing a series of them. I'm creating a new series called The Legends of the Divine Feminine, where I am taking important legends from history and telling those tales in full, and then talking about why they are extraordinary and important lessons to us about the divine feminine and how those lessons have been taught through these stories. And I'm starting with the Ballad of Tamlin for two reasons. One, it's rich, it's magical, it's not all that well known, and I think it should be. But two, there are two incredibly powerful and opposed female characters in this story. You have Janet, who is the heroine, and you have the Fairy Queen, who is the villain. But that's the point. The Fairy Queen is always the villain, right? And if you read the Ballad of Tamlin or hear the Ballad of Tamlin, what you'll find over and over again is that the Fairy Queen is essentially demonic. I mean, they portray her as evil. At the end of 7 years, she pays a tithe to hell. She's going to sacrifice this beautiful young knight after 7 years. And then, you know, off with her voracious appetite, going to go and abduct another one. And this cycle continues. Well, of course, in the fairy worlds, there is no hell. And these are all sort of Christian ideals that were put upon the fairy kingdom to show that they were dangerous. But you see the same thing with Morgan Le Fay. I think that, you know, Morgan Le Fay was my very first muse for The Maligned and the Misunderstood, I think, because she, you know, she's always depicted as the wicked witch in the Arthurian legends, or at the very least as sort of the incestuous, you know, mishap. But more often than not, she's wicked and she's scheming. And you see this over and over again. The Fairy Queen is always evil. She's always the dark side, the dangerous one, and she's capricious and has these voracious appetites. And I'm a strong believer that the Fairy Queen is misrepresented and misunderstood over and over again. And I am Morgan Le Fay's greatest defender. I think that Morgan Le Fay in her time was the goddess incarnate on Earth. She was the high priestess. And I think that the Fairy Queens actually represent the goddess in her darker form. And then the goddess in her darker form is the protector. She is the great protector of her of the world. And in that case, sometimes man is her natural enemy. And so I think that we have two things that happen here. One, certainly with the Arthurian legends, we know that the women in the Arthurian legends were intentionally maligned, because a lot of the Arthurian stuff was written down in the Vulgate cycle, and the women were either eradicated or completely demonized, including Morgan. But I think in the fairy tales, you have more, it becomes part of the cautionary idea. If we make the Fairy Queen bad and dangerous, then, you know, it helps us to know that going into, you know, some of these places is a dangerous thing, and we can caution our children and maybe they won't do bad things. You know, in some cases it was strictly, sensible. Like in Ireland, some of the fairy places are places where there are deep rivers, deep wells that are uncovered, you know, places you don't want your children to go because they could drown or something could happen to them. So they would say, you can't go there because, you know, it's bad, it's dangerous fairy country. So in some cases you have these wicked fairy queens who become the guardians of these places, to sort of create this danger. But you know, there's something deeper going on here with what these queens represent. And in terms of Tamlin, I think this is a really important story. And that's why I'm telling it. And I'm not going to go any further into it here, because I think it's important that people read it in context and understand where I'm going with the story. But hopefully I will have this out and available on Kindle, maybe even by the end of the month, if not by you know, by the equinox, let's do it that way. By the equinox, I'll have the Ballad of Tamlin out and available as a Kindle short. So you can either throw it on your Kindle, or you can download it and you can read the whole story. And what I'm going to do with this series is I'm going to tell these stories, and then there'll be There'll be a fiction component and a nonfiction component. So the novella will be a short fiction, and then behind that will then become the nonfiction component, where I show you all of the research that we've done, the real places that we've gone to, you know, why we ended up in Carter Hall, and what kind of, you know, what the weather was like, and fantastic photos that we were able to take while we were there, and what we discovered in all these places about, you know, these legends, the fairy kingdoms while we're there. So I'm really looking forward to exploring these things in greater detail, both in fiction and nonfiction, because it's such a rich and amazing landscape to be wandering in right now.
And one of the other things which I think is of great interest here is this notion of hybrids. Some of the people who are abducted into fairyland are there to breathe or to make love with the denizens of the other world. And this notion, sometimes that queens or kings were from a family who had bred with sea monsters or fairy queens, something which you find across Europe. And it's very interesting because it once again ties back to this notion, which quite often is interpreted in an ancient alien way, kind of like, you know, is mankind a hybrid creature from extraterrestrial things? And then you have the skeptics or the critics saying, well, if we ever find extraterrestrial life, you know, it's going to be completely different from us. So, and in the Bible, of course, you have the story of the watchers who come here to mate with us. But basically this compatibility of genes, spelled G-E-N-E, not the other way around, is really something which you find also in the fairy tradition. The fact that even though it's a different world, that they're different species, we are compatible. We have more in common than what is different. The notion that somehow they are immortal or timeless or whatever you want to call it, but at the same time, compatible, physical.
Well, I think they're still, in a lot of cases, they're really still human in terms of their form. You know, we find this with Woolpip. Agnes goes on to have children. She is clearly human in that she can reproduce. So, you know, is it that they are just sort of better versions of ourselves? I don't know.
Well, and an interesting thing, you know, the bigger theory, which Duncan will go into to much more detail and will actually back up with some evidence rather than just me talking about it. But Duncan actually feels that, you know, wherever the children came from was otherworldly, was a different planet or a different, you know, something somewhere. But that it was us, that we had gone there in the past, that we sort of colonized it. And then accidentally these kids showed up, and he's also pretty much has found very interesting evidence that to suggest that the kings and other nobles of the land always knew that these two children were not the only people or creatures even who popped from that dimension, from that world, back into our world, and also some kind of you know, conspiracy by the authorities to keep this under wraps,
including the Templars. He has a very interesting Knights Templar connection. I'm not usually a gigantic fan of throwing the Templars into most theories, but in this case I found it extremely interesting, and I think his Templar stories in this book are really worth reading.
And so it once again shows this rich you know, diversity, and I think to a large extent we all live in an age where we are logical and we want to reason and we want to label things, and I quite often think that we classify things like, oh, that's ancient aliens, that is aliens, that is UFO material, this is folklore, this is Celtic folklore, this is about the fairies. But the overall conclusion, I think, is that there are several correspondences between all of those stories, and it's almost as if you have two realities, in the sense that our reality and their existence, or one reality, if you want to you know, put those two together. And then we tell stories, and sometimes the way we tell them become more mystical, more fairy-like, and sometimes some of those details are not taken on board, that, that the writer somehow is more out for facts, that he just wants to say, you know, these were green children and this is very matter-of-factly. And some of the details of what otherwise would easily become a fairy story get lost because some of those details are not put into the original account. And then in some cases, it's a matter of interpretation. And, you know, The Watchers is definitely one of them. There is this desire I always feel of religious institutions to make this into a morality thing. The fact that these creatures come from heaven and mate and then somehow, you know, the deluge comes. This is like your standard moralistic approach that this was an abomination which God had to remove. But when you read the Bible or when you read similar accounts, there's no such thing. In fact, you know, the Bible itself says that descendants of these beings survived. Moses is fighting them as he's making his way to Jerusalem because the descendants of these beings are still living quite prominently in the land of Israel at that moment in time. So what is, you know, trying to be interpreted in a certain way quite often doesn't fit with the facts. And everywhere you get this notion that really what is happening is that our reality, or definitely the reality of our ancestors, was far more interesting, far more diverse than we can imagine. And to a large extent, like, you know, apart from stories like the Versailles time slip, places like Rennes-le-Château, this full-on experience, this day-to-day living next to a forest ruled by the fairy queen, whereby everybody is told, don't go there because your life is in danger. That is very much like part and parcel of what history books are like. It's a very real situation. When you go to Carthor Hall and you read the story of you know, Tamlin, what you get is the heart and soul and bones of this thing. It's a warning of saying, don't go there. Weird things will happen. It's very much in line with that mindset of our ancestors who said that the gods were real and could be experienced. It's matter of fact. It's not science fiction. Mm-hmm. It's not fiction. As beautiful as they are composed, there is a very real aspect to this. This is not myth. This is reality.
No, it completely is, and like I said earlier, and for some people it still is, and I think it's worth revisiting in the grand scheme of the 21st century, because I think that, you know, we're kind of coming full circle again. I think we're coming back to an appreciation of some of these traditions, because they're waking us up to the land. You know, we're in a place where the land is screaming again. You know, so much is happening environmentally, and I think a lot of these stories about fairies and fairy queens are really, again, about guardianing nature. And I think that we're being, you know, asked to look at all of this and become guardians again and to protect what's left of our natural resources. And I think, you know, in doing these things, we find ourselves in a 21st century way kind of aligned with the stories of the fairy queen and her people. We are paying a closer attention to what's happening with the earth, and that's certainly one of the things I want to emphasize with my retelling of the fairy tales.
Absolutely. So to some extent, the environmentalist agenda is a spirit revolution as well, and it's not just our spirit who is revolving, but also very much this bringing back of the fairy realm, which is, you know, possible, and to a large extent, again, popularity like of ancient aliens and various other things are kind of like, again, underlining, I think, this screaming of bringing back balance. But that is a discussion which we will have at a later moment in time, again, and expand on this, because at this moment in time, unless we are broadcasting in Fairyland where we have several more hours, this hour of the Spirit Revolution has come to an end. If you want to listen to the show again, there are, as always, a number of ways of doing this. You can go to the BBS Radio archives or bbsradio.com. A small fee applies to listen to this all our previous shows in the archives, as well as hundreds of other shows and hours and discussions on everything that has to do with the mind, body, and spirit. You can also go to iTunes, where there is about a year and a half of our show archives completely for free and download it as a podcast. You can also go to thespiritrevolution.com, where you can listen to the last five shows completely for free as well. And then there is also our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/spiritrevolution, where you can also listen to this show. In fact, there are more ways to listen to this show than not to listen to this show. But until the next week, from the both of us,
the truth against the world.